Chapter 11 Across the Ages. Fishermen on the shores of the Swiss lakes had complained for years. Their lines caught on the bottom, then snapped, and they lost the hooks. Their nets mysteriously clung to the bottom. Fragments of torn netting tangled up with branches would occasionally float to the surface. There was talk of sunken underwater forests. No one took any notice of their complaints until 1853-54, when a major drought reduced lake levels dramatically. The forests turned out to be wooden posts or piles, sunk into layers of dark sediment. These had once supported huts built above the water. Local antiquarians followed up, and by 1869, they had located more than 200 such lakeside sites. The finds came to the attention of Ferdinand Keller, 1800-81, a professor of English at the University of Zurich and president of the Zurich Antiquarian Society. He led major excavations at a maze of piles visible in the exposed bed of Lake Zurich near the village of Obermillen in 1854. This was an entirely new kind of archaeology for Switzerland, involving organic materials that normally never survived. Unless kept wet, such finds soon dry out, crack, or even crumble into dust. The damp mud had preserved an astounding range of objects that would usually have perished. Axes and adzes with timber handles, wooden wheels, fishing nets, baskets, and ropes. There were lots of cattle, sheep, and goat bones, and the remains of red deer, beaver, and boar. There were numerous wheat and barley seeds, wild fruit, hazelnuts, peas, and beans. Keller's methods were crude. He dug around the posts and recovered as many objects as he could. However, he had no way of dating the site and its contents. The lake-dwelling discoveries came just as Gabriel de Mortier and others brought a ladder-like order of human progress to the Paleolithic period. But many people interested in the remote past wondered about later prehistoric societies. What had happened in Europe as temperatures rose after the Ice Age? When did farming begin in Europe? What crops did such people grow? Keller's discoveries at Obermillen drew back the curtain on some of Europe's early farmers. Keller knew from his finds that his lake dwellings were occupied over several thousand years. But why did the inhabitants build houses on the water? Like Lartey and Christie with the Cro-Magnons, Keller turned to anthropology. He thought immediately of French explorers' descriptions of New Guinea villages, comprising stilt houses built in shallow water. Thus, Keller imagined that the wooden piles were from similar prehistoric stilt houses, whose inhabitants had dropped the tools and food remains into the water beneath their dwellings. He referred to the houses as pile dwellings. Much later, more careful excavation proved Keller wrong. Some Swiss lake dwellings lay on swampy land that had been flooded by rising lake levels. Others had been built above the water and had had posts sunk into the ground to stabilize the structures. As the water rose, fine silt covered the house floors and hearths between the posts, preserving numerous perishable remains of early farming life. Ferdinand Keller's discoveries hit the headlines. Artists painted reconstructions of the villages. They located them, wrongly, on platforms joined to dry land by gangplanks, as if the settlements were on humanly made wooden islands. Unlike the Cro-Magnons, who moved around constantly, these villagers lived at the same location for long periods of time. They had to, because they were farmers, tied to their fields. The remains of their crops survived at the sites. Today, we know that most lakeside settlements like these date to between 4000 BC and somewhere after 1000 BC. Similar kinds of villages occur by alpine lakes in France, Germany, Italy, and Slovenia. In the late 19th century, Obermillen and sites like it became a benchmark for the study of early European farmers. They provided such rich archives of tools and food remains that they became a kind of dictionary for understanding such people, even those who dwelt far from the Swiss lakes. Farmers crave salt to supplement their diet of mainly cereal grains, but also for preserving fish and meat for later consumption. Rock salt was like gold dust for those lucky enough to live close to a source and who were able to trade in it. The Salzkammergut Mountains contain vast quantities of rock salt. People were mining it near Salzburgtal, a small village above the lakeside town of Hallstatt, close to Salzburg, Austria, by at least 1000 BC and probably earlier. Generations of miners worked the Salzkammergut Mountains, among them Johann Georg Ramsauer, 1795 to 1874. He became a mining apprentice at the age of 13. Soon an expert, he rose to the position of Bergmeister, manager of all mining activity. Ramsauer was quite a character. He lived in a medieval fort called the Rudolfsturm, close to the mine. Very much a family man, he raised 22 children who survived to adulthood. His other passion was archaeological excavation. He devoted his leisure time to excavating 1,000 or so graves in an enormous Iron Age cemetery, discovered during construction between Rudolfsturm and the mine. The dead were the Hallstatt people, their culture named by Ramsauer after the local town. They were miners who had dug into the hills by the light of pine torches. The salt had preserved their leather backpacks, gloves, and hats. Ramsauer excavated the cemetery between 1846 and 1863, a period that coincided with the first Neanderthal discovery and the excavations of Swiss Lake villages. To assist him, Ramsauer employed a painter who spent years sketching and recording the finds and the graves. His watercolors show the positions of vessels, metal objects, and other grave furniture relative to the human bones or cremated remains. As the graves were cleaned, they were sketched and described in comprehensive notes. About half were cremations and half were burials. The dead were not chieftains or important people. They were miners and metal workers, buried with ornaments and their tools and weapons. These were expert traders whose metal products and salt spread across wide areas of Europe. They were clearly in touch with long-distance trade networks. Some of them owned ivory ornaments from distant Africa, while others wore amber or fossilized tree resin, beads from the Baltic Sea area. Unfortunately, in 1874, Ramsauer died before publishing his work. Nor did he record the bones or details of the objects found in the graves. His handwritten notes vanished, only to be found in a secondhand bookstore in Vienna in 1932. How reliable they are as a record of the work is uncertain, but they were finally published in 1959. It is a miracle just how much valuable information survived from the enormous excavation. Sadly, however, it represents just a fraction of what could have been learned from the cemetery today. But how old were the lake villages and the Hallstatt cemetery? Today we know that the Hallstatt culture flourished from the 8th to the 6th centuries BC. But in the mid to late 19th century, there was no way of guessing this. The new geology, the theory of evolution, and the Neanderthal discovery had all opened up a vast, unknown landscape of the past. Worsaae's excavations and the three-age system provided a general framework, but still no actual dates for any pre-Roman European society. Fortunately, a Swedish archaeologist, Oscar Montelius, 1843 to 1921, took over where Jens Jacob Worsaae and others had left off. He devoted his career to building chronological frameworks, records of events as they occurred in time, across Europe. It takes a special kind of personality to be an expert on artifacts, especially when almost nothing is known about them. The work requires endless patience, a passion for obscure, often tiny details, and a love of the past. Montelius possessed these qualities in abundance. A brilliant linguist, he was easygoing and personally engaging. In demand as a lecturer, he did much to keep archaeology in the public eye. Montelius was born in Stockholm and spent his entire professional life at the Museum of National Antiquities there, rising eventually to become its director. He was one of the first museum archaeologists. Such scholars spend their careers totally immersed in collections and artifacts. accurate chronologies or timelines based on artifacts and the positions in which they were found were Montilius's passion. He realized from the start that the only way to achieve such timelines was to travel throughout Europe, the Mediterranean, and the Middle East. There, one could find objects dated by the known age of the sites where they were found or by historical records. These artifacts would be the chronological anchors for similar objects found hundreds of miles away in prehistoric Europe. And travel he did. Montilius visited hundreds of museums, many of them in small towns far from big cities. There were no cars, only railways and endless journeys by horse-drawn coach or on horseback. Electric lighting was still unknown, and, of course, there were no typewriters or computers. Everything had to be recorded by hand. Montilius acquired information not only from his own travels, but also from a wide network of colleagues whom he encountered during his journeys or contacted by letter. Over many years of research, Montilius developed his cross-dating technique, using objects of known age from the ancient Egyptians and other Mediterranean civilizations. He linked artifact after artifact across Europe by comparing their minor details and stylistic features. He also compared them to dated objects, bracelets, daggers, clay vessels, and pins, all formed part of Montilius's chronologies. He ended up with interconnected networks of dated artifacts of all kinds that extended from one end of Europe to the other. In 1885, Montilius published his masterpiece, On Dating in the Bronze Age. This brilliant work, based on his study of thousands of objects and the sites where they came from, produced the first timeline for ancient Europe. Using axes, brooches, swords, and other artifacts, he subdivided the European Bronze Age into six time periods. His evidence for these stages, based on huge numbers of finds, was so convincing that it was very soon almost universally accepted. Sometime later, Montilius dated the beginning of the Bronze Age back to 1800 BC. Many of his colleagues thought this too early. But more than three-quarters of a century later, in the early 1970s, radiocarbon dating, unknown in Montilius's day, proved him correct. See Chapter 27. Montilius also believed that archaeologists should share their discoveries with the public. To this end, he lectured and gave guided tours of the museum, talking to a wide variety of audiences. He spoke eloquently in English, French, German, and Italian, all without notes. Numerous popular articles and books flowed from his pen. Influenced by his wife, he also fought for women's rights. In many ways, the leading European archaeologist of his day was far ahead of his contemporaries. By the time Montilius became director of Sweden's Museum of National Antiquities, archaeology had come a long way. Thanks to his thorough research and that of his Scandinavian predecessors, many Europeans were now well aware of the importance of the prehistoric past. However, excavation methods, with a few notable exceptions, were still rough and ready, especially in Mediterranean lands. The lust for museum specimens and spectacular finds continued unabated. But for the first time, there was a framework for Europe before the Romans, based on artifacts and their contexts, and not just on a few great discoveries. In the late 19th century, professional archaeologists were a rare breed. Much archaeology was still little more than casual collecting, and almost all of it was still done in Greece and Italy, the Middle East and Europe. But archaeology was on the move elsewhere, and especially in the Americas. There, the sensational discoveries of John Lloyd Stevens and Frederick Catherwood helped direct other archaeologists' minds towards three fundamental questions. What was the ancestry of the Native Americans? Where had they come from? And how had they crossed into the Americas?